Good evening and welcome to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule, and tonight my guest is G.W. Down. G.W. Down lives in Hamilton with his wife and fellow poet Gertrude Olga Down. Together they operate the Book Band, which provides support for local writers. He's also an executive member of Tower, the longest running poetry society in Canada. One of Down's favorite activities is watching his wife, Trudy, watch birds at their weekend retreat beside Lake Erie. His third book, Sonnets for Sahara Nights, was released in 2019 from Potlatch Publications. Welcome back to Art Waves, G.W. Down.
Thank you very much, Bernadette. It's delightful to be here. It's a great honor. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm really happy to be able to have you on to talk about your book of sonnets. So all the poems in Sonnets for Sahara Nights, as one might guess, are sonnets. Why did you want to work in that beautiful old form?
Well, I have been hearing a lot of talk about how formal classical style poetry is so terribly passé and has nothing to say to modern 21st century audiences. Rhymed poetry is now often said to be only useful if it is for children or for humorous satirical poetry. I wanted to demonstrate that such is not necessarily the case, that classical styles can still speak to modern audiences, and that not every rhyme that might be made has been made, or if it has, perhaps it can be made in a different context. Why specifically the sonnet? Well, the sonnet is a form which allows the writer to explore different avenues within a set framework and perhaps take the entire poem to develop a single metaphor or a couple of metaphors all in one poem. Moreover, once I had come up with the title, Sonnets for Sahara Nights, I realized that if it were to be done properly, all of the poems should be sonnets.
Right. And how did you come to that title?
That was a combination of factors. The first couple of poems that I wrote, these are not necessarily the first in the book, but first chronologically at the time that I wrote them, had to do with hot nights and not being able to sleep, which suggested to me the contrast in the desert. In some deserts, most deserts, I think, it gets cool at night. So this was a bit of a contrast. There was also the essence of unrequited love in this. And it was a saying when I was a much younger man that the avenue for a young man who was unsuccessful in love, rejected in love, was to join the French Foreign Legion and be stationed somewhere remote like Timbuktu. So this started me thinking along those lines. And also there is a young woman I've known, a delightful woman, with a similar name. So those elements came together. And suddenly I said, wow, Sonnets for Sahara Nights, that's maybe a cool title for a book.
It is a cool title. I quite like it. Well, the sonnet takes different forms, right, G.W. Down? I think that the 14-line rule and iambic pentameter are usually left intact. Am I right about that? But then there are other forms, other shapes and end rhyme patterns and so on?
That's my understanding, too. I gather that some scholars say a sonnet can be 12 lines or 15 lines. The classical form is usually the 14 lines. I'm not sure what the criteria would be that would make a 12-line poem still a sonnet, but I tried to keep to the 14 lines. Of the 65 poems in this book, 64 are 14 lines each. The other one is one line shorter for reasons which I hope become apparent when the poem is read. Just to refresh all of our memories, the iambic foot is the two-beat foot with the unstressed stressed, and the pentameter refers to the number of metric foots on the line, five on the line, hence the line is 10 beats.
Right, so it's da-da, 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 generally speaking, right? But you've employed several sonnet forms, meaning the rhyme scheme was different. And I know there's Shakespearean and there's Petrarchan and probably, is there Dantean as well? I don't know. I should have looked all this up.
Dantean would be in the Italian. I don't know what his scheme would be. There is Spenserian, and John Milton used a rhyme scheme which is very similar to the Petrarchan, but sometimes develops the theme a little differently. As to why I used different rhyme schemes, it was part of wanting to demonstrate that the sonnet form is not passé, that it is still very adaptable. I thought it might be more interesting for the reader if they weren't all the same rhyme scheme, same style. And there were instances where I wanted the form of the poem to reflect the content. For example, there's a poem in there in which the narrator talks about an alternate reality in which everything is changed, everything is reversed. The lovers are not star-crossed. Everything is topsy-turvy. So in that poem, if you go to the last line and then look back through the poems at the words at the end of each line, you will see the pattern of the rhyme scheme of a Shakespearean style sonnet. It begins with the couplet and then works backward, and it's an alternate reality. Another example, there's a poem where the poet says, "My heart skipped two beats when we met." That entire poem is written in iambic tetrameter, 8 beats to the line instead of the usual 10. So I was looking for a reflection of the content in the form.
Oh, that is very cool. I missed some of these details when I read it myself. I'll have to go back and look for those. That's wonderful.
Well, there are a few others. One other that I'll mention, as we said earlier, the sonnet is usually written in an iambic pentameter. The reverse foot of the iamb is the trochaic foot, which is stressed, unstressed. And yes, we use the term offbeat, meaning something strange or not quite usual or normal. There's a poem in the book in which I have talked about something being offbeat, and I have used trochaic pentameter as the dominant meter. It's not exclusive. The poem is called, and if we exaggerate this, "Offbeat Musings on Reincarnation." The title itself is a line of trochaic pentameter.
Oh my gosh. Well, that is so interesting to me. I've got to go back in and really examine your pattern.
It's actually perfect that not every reader would notice this. In fact, at one point, Trudy, my wife, said to me, "Do you really expect people, readers, to notice this? And are you going to be upset if they do not?" Well, no, I'll be happy if I can just get readers. If this adds another dimension to their perception of the poem or their enjoyment, all's well and good. But it's not meant to get in the way of the appreciation of the material in the poem.
Well, it certainly doesn't, because you've been very subtle with all these things. You know, I don't hear what Billy Collins famously calls the bongos of poetry hammering out here at all. I mean, they read very naturally, and that is what you want. As you say, you want it to adopt something of natural speech when you write a poem that's in the classical form. And I think you've demonstrated this really well, but you were setting yourself tasks, right, as you
went? Yes, I wanted to challenge myself. For me, the most difficult rhyme scheme is the Spenserian, because it goes A, B, B, A, B, C, C, B, C, D, D, C, and then there's a couplet. Well, once you've picked the tone, the sound for the B, C, and D, you need to rhyme those three times without repetition and, to the best of ability, avoid having it forced or trivial.
Oh, yeah. It can be really a fun kind of project to write a good sonnet. And you have done an entire book of full of them. 65, did you say?
Yes.
65. Wow, what a feat. Okay, well, you've given us a little about the premise of the book. I want to come back to that after I ask you to read us a poem. I think it's time the readers hear your voice in this book. So will you please read us a poem from Sonnets for Sahara Nights, G.W. Down?
With pleasure. This is a poem called Hard Drive to Unhappiness. Somehow, he streamed his way into her life, a charming spammer through a trusted source, an ill-starred net cast for a wealthy wife, dead reckoning on a financial course. No need to hack her bank accounts, for she was mesmerized, discovered much too late the sordid virus he turned out to be. At length, he learned the truth of her estate and found its worth exaggerated. But by then, the victorious suitor's crown was his. He'd wormed his guile, her helplines cut, and I had seen my world come crashing down. So that was how she came to be with him and made my dreams seem mere benighted whim.
Okay, and you hear that lovely rhyming couplet that closes the sonnet that is so satisfyingly. It's just a lovely little silent click of the door, you know? Beautiful.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's talk more about the premise of the book being this unrequited love, this lover who falls in love with someone who isn't loving him back, and it's bound to end badly. How autobiographical, people tend to think when they're reading poems, especially those who haven't read a lot of poetry, they would tend to think that this is very autobiographical, that it has to be. You're writing it, your name is on it, and the I in the poem is the writer. But it seems to me you have established a kind of fictional couple here. Am I right about that?
Yes, this is not autobiography. There are, in places, there are a few lines and a few references scattered through the book that are autobiographical in nature.
Well, sure.
In one of the poems, the narrator speaks of his heritage, his lineage. And I have an ancestor who married a girl from below stairs and was disinherited. There's another reference to being a watchman, a night watchman. And during my last year at university, I did have a job as a security guard, night watchman. I would go to classes late in the day, then change into my security guard uniform and go off and prowl the premises as a watchman at night. In one of the poems, there's a line, "Most of what I am is memory." And that really is the link between me and the fictional narrator of this book. Someone said to me, "You've been happily married for almost 48 years. What do you know about unrequited love?" Quite a bit, actually, because of my memory, I remember what it was like to be a teenager, a young person very much in love with someone else and finding that that wasn't necessarily going to work out. I know what it's like to be the short, blonde, ugly fellow when most of the girls are talking about Mr. Tall, Dark, and Handsome. And I know what it's like when you're drawn to someone, you're attracted to someone, but, oh, well, she's from a wealthy family. What would she ever have to do with me? So I take some of that memory and I use that in creating this fictional character and plugging him into certain circumstances where things don't work out, or at least they have an up and down relationship with this woman to whom he's greatly attracted, and we see where it goes from there.
Okay, and what made you want to explore unrequited love as opposed to requited love?
Well, I guess that started with a friend of mine who lives in British Columbia and has set some of my poetry to music. We've collaborated on a few songs. And he said to me at one point, I'd like to do a song that is about not only unrequited love, but if there is such a word, unrequitable love. Oh, well, there's a concept. No one's ever tried anything like that before, I'm sure, I said. Well, let's see what we can do. I tried to give him some lyrics a few times, and it didn't connect. Ultimately, we did do one, but I guess he started me thinking about the problems, what happens in unrequited love, and what that feels like. And I guess it went on from there.
Yeah, well, you know, just as they say, it's easier to describe and explore evil than good in literature. I think unrequited love is sometimes leaned upon by, because we've all felt it, and I think most people have felt it, and it is something that is striking and strong in life, and so it makes for a good read that way as well. The fact that you have used fictional characters throughout your book here interests me as well, because it certainly happens in poetry, but it is not as common as autobiographical or confessional poetry, especially in these days. But two writers spring to mind who I remember saying at one time or another really couldn't imagine writing about their own personal life, their own interior life, for the world to read. So they had to create fictional characters. One is the Canadian, well, they're both Canadian poets, Ricardo Sternberg and Richard Outram have both made those comments that they prefer to have, they create these characters and then they can follow them anywhere in the world and do what they like with them. And it's very freeing. So I find this interesting that you've done this now as well. Okay, so you talked about why the Saharan Nights, the book isn't actually set in Africa, but let's talk about your cover image. There's water on the cover image, and that there's a nice contradiction with the title and the cover image. It's the moon reflected over a lake or something like that. Can you talk a little about who was that cover image something that you did, your own artwork, or did you find it online, or how did that come about?
This is actually a picture taken from the deck of our property on Lake Erie.
I wonder. So
the picture was taken by my in-house photographer, Trudy Down. She's marvelous with a camera and with Photoshop. I had asked her for a picture of a full moon reflected on the water in the spirit of perhaps the oasis in the desert, also the contrast with the desert, because as you mentioned, the book is not set in Africa. The Sahara is a woman. At times I compare with the desert, sometimes I contrast, but I wanted a picture that would reflect something different from the idea of a wasteland.
Okay, well, you got it. It's a lovely cover image. So G.W. Down, I'd like to have you read us another poem, but before we go much further, would you like to give the name of your friend who puts your poems to music?
Oh, that's Mr. Simon Farrell. He lives in Kelowna, British Columbia. We've had a couple of small concerts. I think we have about a half a dozen songs that we did together. He did the music and I did the lyrics. It started when I sent him a copy of a previous book of mine. And he saw one of the poems and he said, oh, I can hear the music. And then he just set it to music and said, well, it's easier to get forgiveness than permission. Well, I said, well, you would have had permission anyway. And so we collaborated on a few more, but I think he's no longer composing music. So we just have the small canon of music, of songs that we put together before.
Well, how did it affect you to hear your poem set to music?
Well, the first time it was very interesting. It was a different beat, a different sound from what I had expected. I should say that what he composes is four-part harmony, four singers, sung a cappella. So tenor, alto, bass, and baritone, well, either or alto or countertenor. So to hear these four voices blending with just a few words I'd written the first time, it was spectacular.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
He said, can we do a few more? So I wrote a few more sets of lyrics, and he set them to music.
Oh, that must have been thrilling. That would be really fun. I imagined that you were reading and there was just music in the background that matched kind of, you know, the mood. But no, this sounds...
No, they sing the lyrics, yes.
Is there anywhere people can hear these? Have you got them on YouTube or someplace?
No, we haven't. That would have been a good idea. We did make a recording. Another friend of mine made a recording when we did a concert in a local church some years ago. But it's not the fault of the recording. The setup of the microphones, I think, was not ultimately the best. So sometimes the voices don't come through quite as they should.
Pity. Well, you know, maybe there's still time. Maybe you'll get this together for YouTube yet. I hope you will. All right, G.W. Dan, please read us another poem from Sonnets for Sahara Nights.
Now, this is a poem called Riding High. When balanced on the tandem bicycle of desire, we pedaled faster till, in sharpened heat, we lanced the vesicle of doubt that had been threatening to spill us as on asphalt, bruised and blistered, spent and saddled with a lingering remorse. Still more we rode, our passion in ascent. We ceased to question our misgiving's source and strove to burst its barriers instead. We pushed our surging pulse to higher gear. And though you seemed to stay one spring ahead, I did not lag behind. Ignoring fear our joy might prove to be impermanent, we wheeled along in wild abandonment.
Again, that beautiful rhyming couplet to close. You really are indulging in some wonderful wordplay, some internal echoes, as well as the rhyme pattern. You know, George Down, you have a sort of 19th century formality and grace about you in general. I have always noticed this. I never forget how you used to stand up when I or any woman entered the room. I was just like, wow, there was something so nice about that. You wore a tailcoat to your launch and it suited you perfectly. First of all, how does a man in the 21st century come by this sensibility? Does Untimely Reluctance, the poem in the book, does that speak to this at all?
The first question there was, how does a man of the 21st century come by this? How much of one's persona is hereditary and how much is environmental? Behavioral scientists are struggling, they're testing, looking into this question. I don't think they'll ever come up with a complete answer. I think that this sort of thing varies from person to person as to how much it's very common now for people to say, oh, don't blame me, it's in my DNA.
But were you like this as a child? Were you a formal little bitty boy?
Yes, even then I was accused of being old-fashioned. It's not easy sometimes to be like that in a modern setting. If I hold a door open for a woman, there's a almost 50-50 chance that she might say, I don't need you to do that. How dare you? I'm perfectly capable of opening the door myself.
Yeah.
Well, of course you are. That's not the point. I'm doing this to show deference to you, to show respect for who you are and what you represent, the best of our species. And this whole phenomenon may disappear anyway soon because we have so many push-button doors and electric eyes that why worry about it? Now, having said that it may be difficult to be this way in a modern era, I have to add that we do live in an enchanted era in one way, in that the past can coexist with the present. We can see the artwork of Monet and Rembrandt alongside K. Ken Danby, Gail Connolly, John DeLeonardo, and if you like it, Jackson Pollock. We can listen to Beethoven and Bach, and we can also listen to the rapper, Mr. Ice-T, and the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. So we have a wonderful spectrum of culture to enjoy in this era. And I just hope that we can all respect each other and each other's foibles. If I do happen to open the door for a woman, I hope that she'll try to understand that I'm actually not belittling her. It's quite the reverse.
Right. Well, I always sensed that respectfulness from you and really enjoyed it. Okay, now the second part of the question. First of all, what about the Untimely Reluctance poem? Does it, you want to read it?
Well, all right. I'll have to find it, I'm sorry.
There's a little Untimely Reluctance going on here, so.
I guess I'm a little Untimely Reluctant, yes.
I'll remind our listeners while you're looking for it that you are listening to Art Waves. I'm Bernadette Rule, and my guest tonight is the writer G.W. Down.
All right, so here it is. Untimely Reluctance. Anachronism that I am, torn from another era, I discern no way to counter the reluctance that holds sway and pastes ancestral fragments splashed with rum compunction on the looming frame of some pervasive joy with you. The future may envelop us in winsome patterns, lay cloths of consummate charm to overcome the pressing strength of scruples, make inroads to render my ingrained malaise benign. But sensate honor, deeply rooted, loads its gallantry against the heart's desire. Creatures cannot survive without their codes. You follow yours, and I must cope with mine.
Yeah, I see why I thought of your gallantry. The word gallantry is perfect. That's exactly what I always have experienced with you. So you gave this quality to your fictional character.
Yes, I did. I think it's not uncommon for people to feel that, I might have been happier living in another era. I feel like I belong more to the 1930s or the 1890s or whatever. I think it's perhaps a common feeling every now and then. And it's one that I thought I should address. And yes, I infused that into the character. In this poem, he, of course, is struggling with the desire he has to be with this woman, and yet a strict moral code stops him because she is at that point married to someone else. So it's, I'm not sure, this is where probably I differ from the character in the book, because I'm not so sure that I would have been so scrupulous given a similar circumstance.
Really? George, I feel you would. Okay, well, this leads us nicely to our next question, which is, what time frame or era have you imagined Sonnets for Sahara Nights to be set in? One of my favorite poems, Folly, features a telephone, and there are a few other references to modern day technologies, yet the telephone we know was invented in the late 1900s, and came into use in households then. I mean, sorry, the late 1800s, 19th century. But you've used the timeless language of love with words like cupidity, purity, bosom, destiny, cherish, gallantry, etc. So where are Sahara and the narrator on the chronological spectrum?
Well, I saw them as being in the 21st century. As you say, there are references to a telephone. There's a reference to computers. I read the poem where the narrator talks about how this other fellow got into the woman's life through the internet. There's a poem that includes a reference to, well, actually it's a metaphor about a missile, a torpedo that can home in on its target. So these are 21st century items. But I feel also that poetry, which is not for a specific event, should have a timeless quality to it. So even though there are 21st century references, I hope that some of these poems resonate with different eras. In Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, a clock chimes. That would not have happened in 50-something BC, but it doesn't make us feel that, oh, we're definitely not in ancient Rome. We are, but we're also in an ancient Rome that represents many different eras. So I would, as I said, I envisioned it as being in the 21st century, but I would hope that the poems could be perceived as being in the here and now, whenever and wherever that is.
Well, I think that is one of the things you've achieved here by using such carefully structured patterns for the poems and such classic patterns, and also having your characters be, you know, stand outside of the realm of time, being timeless, as you say, and yet using this natural modern world to do this. It's like getting dressed up for a peace march or something. It really makes people stop and think, because it's not what you expect. G.W. Down, when did you first start writing poetry?
I wrote my first poem when I was 10 years old. It's in iambic tetrameter, and it's rhymed couplets.
Wow, okay. Was this a school project?
Yes, I think I was cheating on a school project, because we were given a few words and told to write an essay beginning with that. I was a little bit lazy, and I thought, well, instead of an essay, I'll just write a poem, and I can do it in less time and still fulfill the requirements of the assignment.
Well, it's kind of amazing that for a first-time poet, you thought it would be easier and quicker, and you were thinking of it as a lazy activity. I bet you spent as much time on it as most of the kids spent on their essays. Who are some of your favorite poets, and why?
Well, there's the Roman poet Catullus. Canabis bene me fabulo apud me, from the poem Come to Dinner, But Bring Your Own Food. And he writes about his lesbia, his dulcissima puella, his sweetest girl. So I've always been a fan of Catullus. I'm very much a fan of Dylan Thomas. I suppose we should mention William Shakespeare, especially since I argued with him in the book at one point. And Alfred Noyes, who wrote the Highwayman.
Yes.
That was one of the poems that first attracted me to the music that poetry can be.
It is spectacular for kids to hear that poem. They love it.
Yes, very much. For modern poets, locally, I've had the pleasure of meeting a number of very good poets, too many to mention. There's a local poet by the name of Bernadette Rule, whose work I very much admire, especially her book about Tom Thompson.
Oh, and thank you.
And one of my favorite poets is Gertrude Olga Down.
Okay.
I always appreciate her stuff. Now, it's possibly because when she writes of a particular incident, I know exactly what she was talking about, because for many of them, I was there. But I admire the way she is always keen on quality rather than quantity. And I have seen her work hard to get just the right tone into a poem.
Okay, nicely said. And you are such a romantic, I have to say. You're wonderful to listen to talk about Trudy Down, your wife. Okay, G.W. Down, why did you not write this love story that is written in Sonnets for Sahara Nights? Why did you not write it in prose?
That might have been the smarter thing to do, because there are more people who are willing to read a prose novel than read poetry. And there might have been spin-offs, movie rights, residuals, and perhaps a Sahara action doll. But I didn't think of that soon enough.
Yeah, and think of the cute little toys. You could have a little bicycle built for two and a little telephone and a little computer.
All sorts of concomitant ideas. But I'm still open to suggestions. If any movie producers are out there listening to this and are interested in expanding the story, it wouldn't be the first time that a movie has been based on a poem.
We'll give an example.
There's a movie made in, I think, the 1950s or thereabouts of Alfred Noyes, The Highwayman.
Oh, really?
And it begins with the opening lines from the poem and then fans out from there to the backstory of the relationship between the highwayman and the landlord's daughter. And toward the end, it comes back to where the poem concludes with the redcoats marching up to the inn and seizing the landlord's daughter.
Yes, indeed. Oh, it's a tragic poem. Wow. Well, that's very interesting. And you know, they do say that the best movies are made not from novels, but from short stories, like Shawshank Redemption, for example. It seems to be the case that they can't do on a screen in 2 hours. They can't do the kind of detail that you can do in a book, in a novel, but they can do what you could do in a short story. And so, yeah, interesting concept. Maybe it'll happen yet. Maybe Hollywood is listening in. We don't know.
Hope springs eternal.
Hope springs eternal. Yes. I'm sure that Hollywood often tunes in to 101.5 The Hawk, where you are tonight. Okay, so G.W. Down, do you have any readings coming up where listeners can hear you read? Of course, we're in COVID times, so this was...
Yes, sadly, I was scheduled to read at Hamilton's Lit Live in October, but Lit Live has been, suspended indefinitely. The Tower Poetry Society, which will be celebrating its 70th anniversary next year, was planning a few readings to celebrate that, and I was hoping to take part in some of those. How much of that will happen remains to be seen. In the meantime, if there are any small groups, book clubs or whatever, that would like to have me meet them either socially distanced in person or by Zoom or whatever, I'm open to that.
Okay, how would people reach you for that?
They can email me at info@thebookband.com. Everything is lowercase, and that's info@thebookband.com.
Great. Okay, so anyone out there who's looking for someone to have to their book club, if you haven't, and I bet you haven't, had a poet come in to talk about the poetry book, this would be an excellent one. It would give you lots of scope for discussion. And George, as you can hear, is very eloquent in speaking about the poems and why he wrote them the way he did and so on. So you can contact him again at info@thebookband.com if you'd like to have G.W. Down come to your book club or any other group that you have if you'd like to have him come for a reading. He's open to doing that. Yes, I should also mention to our listeners that we will be podcasting this at archive.org/details/artwaves. So you can listen to it at any time in the future. And in case you are listening in the future, we went to air for this in August of 2020 in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic lockdown. So that is why we're saying readings are kind of down for the moment and we don't really know what to expect for the immediate future, but we know someday we'll be back up and reading poetry again in groups and loving that. So now, where can people buy Sonnets for Sahara Nights?
It is available in some local bookstores, local independent bookstores. It is also available online at www.thebookband.com, and it's $12.
All right, and worth it. So www.thebookband.com. Essentially, if you can remember the Book Band, which is George and Trudy Down's writer's support group, you'll find a lot of interesting things through them. And that is where you will also find G.W. Down's Sonnets for Sahara Nights. Okay, now, can you read us another poem?
Well, you had mentioned in one of your correspondences with me that this is one of your favorites. So I'll read the poem called Folly. I was afraid to conjure up your face. Distraught, your gaze would burn behind my eyes. I was afraid to telephone your place. The sounds your lips can craft might compromise decisions made, endanger the resolve which until now remains and feels secure, though tugging at its chain. I cannot solve the knots that hold the past in range, nor cure the current sorrowing malaise that slinks within a thousand shades of memory. So often, time's a predator that sinks its claws into the timid, draws them free, and quickly makes the line of folly clear. Perhaps that's why I drew the handset near.
Yeah, I really like that one. There's something about your use of the word handset, which is both modern and old-fashioned, and just completely does that thing you do so well, which is to lift us out of a very fixed time period, and yet using a piece of technology, a very amazing that you can do that. And of course, you explore there all the hesitation, all the fear that the person is feeling when he's reaching out to contact the woman that he loves so much. Okay, thank you for that, GW Down. Now, spoiler alert, there's not a happy ending for the lovers in the book. I think we've already mentioned that. Now, I said, you know, why not? According to all the evidence, you have had and are in a very happy marriage. So why do so many of our literary characters have to be thrown under the bus at the end? We talked about that a little bit. I wonder how different the book would have been had you given them a happy ending. I guess we'll never know.
Well, Dylan Thomas wrote, "Though lovers be lost, love shall not, and death shall have no dominion." So I think that one of the reasons so much of our literature deals with unhappy, well, not necessarily unhappy endings, but endings where separation takes place, is to remind us that the ones we love, we may enjoy their presence right now, and should to the extent that we can, because in this stage of existence, there's a necessary impermanency. Certainly, someone you're happily married to, unless you're very fortunate, you're not both going to go at the same time. There's going to be a separation. And so we should be prepared for that. It reminds us that there is an impermanency. And so take advantage of the permanency while you can.
Again, there's that classic irony there, you know, take advantage of the permanency while you can. You should have that on a t-shirt, actually. I think that's really good. You could probably sell a million. Okay, GW Down, what are you working on these days in terms of your writing?
I always have a number of projects on the go, and that's problematic because if you don't devote enough time to any one of them, they don't advance far enough and nothing gets done. So I do have to try to overcome that tendency to work on too many things at once. Lately, the project to which I've been devoting the most attention is a collection of poems about chess pieces and the relationships between them, focused primarily on the pawn, who, if you know the game of chess, if a pawn advances to the eighth rank, he can be promoted to another level, another rank, another position. So this set of poems, the pawn is anxious to get across the board and on to the next stage of existence, but at the same time, hesitant, doubtful about what the future might hold. So the whole thing becomes a metaphor for life.
Very interesting. How many of those have you gotten so far? Do you know?
I've got about a quarter of what I expect the book to be. I'm hoping it'll be 64 poems to represent the 64 squares on the chessboard. I was going to make it 32 for each of the 32 pieces,
not quite a full book.
That wouldn't be big enough for a book.
So, no. Are you using a classical form in these poems?
No. no, these are not sonnets. There will be different patterns in the writing. Much of it is set to a certain rhythm, but nothing, nothing that pervades the whole book.
Wonderful. Sounds very interesting. Well, we'll just talk about that one project then, so as not to further split your thinking so that we don't slow you down in your writing. Will you read us one last poem, G.W. Down?
This is the last poem in the book. And you've already given a spoiler alert. There isn't an entirely happy ending. But what I was trying to do in this poem was to point out that even when you're apart, you're not really apart. Goodbye is actually derived from the words God bide with ye, similar to adios in Spanish, go with God, and French adieu. So that was the underlying drive for this poem. And it's called Goodbye, Darling. To say goodbye in parting makes no sense, for goodbye gives the wish of company, the presence of abiding sustenance from pure and constant strength divinity. True, if we were to sever all our ties, each would no longer clasp the other's grace. Yet I will see you by my other eyes and cord your essence tight in my embrace. Insisting you will not be left alone, my words bid more than for you to fare well. They bind us, lashed as one wherever thrown, or bashed by stormy fears we cannot quell. Preserved within the power of love's will, we, though disjoined, shall be together still.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do kind of give them a happy ending in a way, as much as you can. Oh, very good. It's been fascinating to hear you talk about your book. I only have my last question to ask you now. G.W. Down, what piece of music have you chosen for us to close Heart Waves with tonight, and why that one?
This was difficult to decide upon because I had thought of, since the sonnet form is derived from an Italian form, I was going to choose Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony, the first movement. Seemed natural for sonnets, and it would have a double significance because the first movement was used as the music for the opening titles in that movie, The Highwayman, that I referred to. And of course, The Highwayman was a major influence in drawing me further into poetry. So I was going to choose that, and then I remembered I don't have a recording of the Italian Symphony. So all of that planning went down to defeat. I have chosen a song which I think expresses much about love, and this is, of course, a book about love. This is from the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical Aspects of Love. It's from a CD on which Michael Crawford sings various songs from musicals composed by Andrew Lloyd Webber. And from Aspects of Love, this is Love Changes Everything.
Okay. Well, that will be the song that we will close Art Waves with tonight. Love Changes Everything, sung by Michael Crawford, written by Andrew Lloyd Webber. And it is the song choice of my guest tonight, G.W. Down. George, it has been a delight to hear you talking about your latest book. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Bernadette. Thank you very much.
Well, most delightful. And I hope that you, our listeners, have enjoyed it as well. I'm sure you have. And I hope that you'll be able to join me next week on 101.5 The Hawk at 7 p.m. Sunday night when I will be back. And until then, this is Bernadette Rule wishing you a good night on the shores of Lake Ontario.
Love changes everything, hands and faces, earth and sky. Love changes everything, how you live and how you die. Love. summer fly, or a night seem like a lifetime. Yes, love changes everything. How I tremble at your name. Nothing in the world will ever be the same. Love changes everything.
Days are longer, words mean more.
Love changes everything.
It is deeper than before.
Love will turn your world around, and that world will last forever. Yes, love changes everything, brings you glory.